Pulp Arcana, the Vintage Pulp Paperback Morgue.
If you look closely, they are all around. The hooded jogger who rattles past you without seeming to touch the ground. The young housewife whose soulless eyes burn right through you. The businessman whose pearly smile hides a breath reeking of the grave. Outwardly, they seem normal, perhaps too normal. But each and every one is infected with evil and dead to the world. The spine-tingling new horror story by J.N. Williamson, author of Noonspell, Evil Offspring, and The Tulpa, a leisure book, 1988. Alive with evil, dead to the world. Graham Masterton calls it an experience of unmitigated terror.
Alright, welcome to the Skull Session review. This time our main feature on Pulp Arcana podcast is J.N. Williamson's Dead to the World. And today I have joining me, this is JBM, I have Roger from the official Slasher Pepper. What's your YouTube?
Slasher Pepper it is.
Heck yeah. So he's done plenty of reviews on horror fiction. He has a nice collection. He's in film school right now. How's film school going? You're in your first semester. Fun.
It's really, I'm really busy with it at the moment. Luckily, I have vacation right now, so I could take the time to do this podcast with you. I'm excited to talk about this atrocious book. But yeah, it's all fun for sure.
Yeah. I get to blame him for talking me into getting this one. This is one of the classic, we'll start off with the covers. This is one of the classic skeleton, active skeleton covers. I've always had to get it.
Yeah, it's definitely my favorite cover that I own myself. The Skull Jogger is amazing. I absolutely love it. The title's really cool, I think. Unfortunately, the book itself does not share the same quality as the cover.
Yeah, so in the late 80s, Leisure started to copy Zebra a little bit and do the black canvas backdrop with the reanimated skeleton. And this is the one with the skeleton, like, casually jogging in that, like, eerie glow, like a shaft of blue light. He's in blue sweats. It's full on, like, we've seen skeletons perform many odd things for their condition, and this corpse is exercising.
Yeah, like it has any muscles. I definitely like the fact that the jogger's clothes has blue and red, because blue, of course, is also the like weird background lighting, and red is the title, so it definitely has some great colors that really pop out.
Yeah, I felt that way too. It's pretty vivid that way, and he looks in great shape. He fills out that jogging suit.
Oh yeah, for sure. Probably when it was drawn realistically, it would look a lot different. But yeah, I this looks more natural, I guess.
Yeah, like And he's so placid and phlegmatic and calm. Like, there's a grace to his stride, and it even comes out in the character. I think at one point, J.N. Williamson uses the analogy that he's running up the hill like a wafted autumn leaf.
Yeah, and even on the, I think it also says it on the back. Yeah, if you look closely, they are all around you. The hooded jogger who rattles past you without seeming to touch the ground.
Yeah, I have a few different, and this guy appears throughout. You get it. Unlike in some horror comic books or some horror covers, you actually get this monster. This guy is a central character.
Yeah, which I actually liked, I guess, because you a lot of times the cover is just an eye catcher, you know, and it has nothing to do with the book itself. Even on one book by John Coyne. It's called Hobgoblin. There are like monsters on the back summary that are not in the book itself.
Yeah, that's the Dungeons and Dragons role playing type game from the early days that he wrote. And I recently saw in a group where there's like so many different international, since that game was so pervasive throughout the world, there's so many different international covers for that book too. There's one collector who has like five different covers of the Hobgoblin.
Yeah, I have the golden one, but indeed I've seen like many different covers of that book.
You have the one where it's like the cell, like the prison cell.
Yeah, I got that one.
So do I. Well, all right. So it was released in 1988. I got the book. Do you got the leisure copy or the BMI copy?
I got the leisure copy.
Okay, so yeah, it was published in 1988. My retail price on it is $3.95. I'm opening it up now. It tells you there's other leisure books by J.N. Williamson. Noon Spell, The Hoongan, The Talpa, The Longest Night, Premonition, Playmates, Wards of Armageddon, Brother Kind, The Offspring, Evil Offspring, Ghost, The Ritual, and Queen of Hell. So, he was definitely a prolific writer in the horror genre. He didn't publish his first book until 1979, but that was right when horror started to come on. So, he was one of the more recognized writers of the time.
Yeah, I actually own Horror House. That's one that wasn't mentioned in this book that he wrote because it was published later, was released later than Dead to the World. I've yet to read it, but if it's as good as Dead to the World, I'm not looking forward to reading it.
Yeah, Grady Hendrix in another podcast, who is known for devouring gluttonous amounts of horror fiction, who wrote Paperbacks from Hell, when he was asked about he thought the most terrible writer, he condemned J.N. Williamson and compared his prose to reading, it's like chunks of cement blocks being shot at you out of a tennis ball.
That's the way you say it.
And I feel the same way. I've written down what his prose is. I found it. He crams like every idiosyncrasy about a character into like so many paragraphs, and the action doesn't really flow too well. It's kind of clunky and cluttered, and
yeah,
and he doesn't weave his adjectives or adverbs in there gracefully enough. They're kind of stumbling blocks. It's just hard to like get in a rhythm to read it. And me and you, we were just talking before we recorded this, like, we started reading this back in July is when I finally got the book. And I've read several books in between it just because I've always had to set it apart. And then you started film school, too. And, yeah, even for an advanced reader who's read a lot of shit but never read J.N. Williamson, like, Like, I read Shakespeare and stuff, and but this is tough. Like, his style is just grating to the senses.
Yeah, and also, like, I tried to reading it in the bus and train, like, while traveling to school. But even then, I was like, okay, you know, I'll just put it down and go studying. Like, that was more interesting than Dead to the World.
Oh, I know. I was, like, dead to this book. I was really dead to the world when I was reading this shit, man. Like, I couldn't wait to just... I could only take, like, 10 pages at a time. I had to keep setting it aside.
But usually, when it comes to, like, bad books and I, like, want to quit halfway through, which I would have done if I didn't... If it wasn't for this podcast. This book had so much potential. Like, in my head, I got, like, a whole remake of this book with, like, political messages and stuff. That would have been way, like, if I do say so myself, would have been way better than what Dead to the World is as we know it.
Yeah. You don't know which direction he's going to take it because there's a lot of characters to get used to at the start. Yeah. But to go over his little profile before we jump into the book, I'm going to say J. Ed Williamson was an Indiana native, so he was a Hoosier, and that's where this book is set, in Indiana. I know you're from Scandinavia, Netherlands, okay. So Indiana is kind of in the Midwest. I live in Michigan. It's just below us. It's in the central time zone, just outside the East Coast time zone, right sandwiched in between Illinois and Ohio. So there's a lot of farmland. It's not known as a metropolis type of area. But so his name was Jerry Neal Williamson, born in 1932, the same year as my grandma, but he died in 2005, unfortunately. I know he was a smoker. He's published for Playboy, Zebra, and Leisure, among others. His Playboys, I have a few of those. He did The Banishing, which is just a fantastic cover. It's like these little, like, City of the Damned type children, like, gathered around in a circle, holding this orb, like, up in the air as it's glowing. It's just so occultic and enticing. And
I think then I've seen one, actually, that cover.
There's that one. There's an alternate cover of it, but that's a really badass one. I just had to get it. I found it for like $7 a few years ago online.
Let me stop you there for 1 second. So do you know what? He was born on the 17th of April, right?
I didn't know the exact date, but I believe you. 17th of April, okay.
Yeah, because I was born on the 17th of April as well.
Oh, were you? That's crazy. My son was scheduled to be born on the April 17th.
And was he born on the 17th?
No, we ended up getting an induction a week earlier. So he was born the 12th.
Ah, I see.
Same day that R. Lee Emery from Texas Chainsaw Massacre died in 2018.
Oh, man.
But so you share a birthday with J.N. Williams, and that's pretty dope.
Yeah, who knows? Maybe I'll make a remake of Dead to the World, but in a movie form.
You'd have to rewrite a lot of elements and
oh, for sure.
And drastically update the whole premise.
For sure, I would.
So he studied at Shortridge High School in Indianapolis, and he also studied journalism at Butler University, which is a huge basketball school in Indiana. Usually does pretty well in the NCAA tournament. And his first published novel was 1979's The Banishing, I believe. Actually, I think it was a different book. I didn't write it down. I know The Banishing was published in either 79 or 1980, maybe the early 80s. He's published, and then he went on to publish 40-plus novels and 150 short stories.
Wow. That's crazy.
Yeah. And let's see here. So he was well into his 40s, just like William W. Johnstone when he started writing. Like, William W. Johnstone wasn't, I think he was in his early 40s too when he started writing, and they both went on to have huge, prolific careers. And they only died a year apart too, because Johnstone died in 2004 and Williamson died in 2005. I believe they were both smokers. Anyway, so in 2003, he received a Lifetime Achievement recipient. I believe he was even the, at one point, in the head leadership of the Horror Writers Association back in the 80s, because I know he was close friends with Dean Koontz and several other prominent writers.
Well, you for sure had a big impact on the, like, all of the paperbacks from Hell and all the horror books from the 80s, because he's wrote a lot of horror books.
Yeah, and everyone recognizes most of his covers, too.
Yeah, I mean, just look at the World cover, it's a classic.
Yeah, then there's The Ritual, where it's like a bleeding candle.
Yeah.
And then he has his Death Coach series, where it's like the hearse and like a wooden or a horse and buggy carriage of a hearse coffin.
Or The Dentist is also an awesome cover.
Yeah. And then Horror House. Which one, I forgot to ask you, which one do you have? The red colored one of Horror House, or do you have like the YA colored?
I have the one with like a mouth as a door.
Yeah. That's the reprinted one. The YA one has like the little girl and it looks like it's a Fear Street cover.
Yeah, I saw that one before indeed.
You got your computer up? Can you look up other J.N. Williamson covers on Google?
Okay, one sec.
All right, I'm on my phone, so I can't really look at it. So, others of his was The Ritual, Horror House, Playmates.
The Offspring.
Oh, yeah, there you go. I think I just got that one. Is that the one where it's like the woods?
I thought it was the mummy. The Offspring is the one with like a mummy laying.
Oh, okay.
You got Death Coach. Also an amazing cover.
Yeah, that's the one I got recently too.
Or Bloodlines, Death Angel, Premonition.
Oh yeah, that's the roller coaster ride one.
Death Doctor.
What does that cover look like?
That it's like a oh man. I'm not sure what it's called. It's like a car for babies, you know, but like a really vintage
like
one.
Like a cradle or a carriage?
Yeah, a cradle. And then there's like a ghost, an evil ghost behind it, like in the background, inside a fog. Like his face is shaped in the fog.
Hell yeah.
So yeah, they have Death School, The Black School, Noon Spell, Don't Take Away the Light. So yeah, of course, a lot of horror books with some great covers.
Yeah, and he was lucky to get some really great covers. All right, so that's our little overview of J.N. Williamson. We'll now talk about the book. I'm going to stop this recording, and then we'll take over at the top of the hour here.
Okay.
All right. Be right back. Pranks by Dennis J. Higman. Hurt him, hurt him, hurt him. Bucky's head screamed at his body, and he charged, snarling and spitting, driving his head into the big man's breastbone, cursing him, tearing, punching, kicking. Olsen stepped back in surprise, stumbled over the axe,
but managed to grab Bucky in a bear hug before they both fell on the dock. "Kill! Kill! Kill!" Bucky screamed, and clamped his hands around the old man's neck. He could feel the slow chug of the dark arterial blood coming to a strangling stop. Bucky Foster was poised on the tip of ecstasy. Pranks by Dennis J. Higman. Published by Dorchester in 1983.
Dead to the World. We're opening up the pages now. So we finished it, and we are on. Let's meet the characters and the premise. So, essentially our cast of characters are a group of phone room personnel on a road trip to Stillwind, Indiana. It's their business. They're laying phone lines. They're signing people up for different phone deals. And what do you think about that premise?
I mean, it's kind of a basic premise. It's just like a group of characters going to a place they don't really know. And then, like, shit happens.
It's definitely an obsolete profession.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
They're trying to sign up different households and businesses to get phone lines into their house. Not cell phones, obviously, because we're dealing in the late 80s here.
Exactly. So, yeah.
So they go to the middle of nowhere in Indiana. They arrive in this town called Stillwind, Indiana. And there's a lot of back and forth banter where we're meeting the different characters and obviously, I felt kind of them just, a lot of them were just pointless, and you didn't even really get to need to know a few of them, you know, outside of our main character, Wes, who is essentially the head boss of the group, you know?
Yeah, and other than Wes, like, all of the other characters, like, I already forgot them.
Yeah, they're pointless. It's his crew. It's his dad, who's older than him. His dad should be retired. He's fucking 70, like, trying to sell, like, phone lines in the 80s. and like, I guess his dad was like a communist, and so they bicker about that back and forth about capitalists and communists. And his dad has a few good one-liners, but his dad tells some weird stories, and there's a lot of jargon written. Like, it's written in vernacular style because they're kind of more hick type of Hoosiers. What'd you feel about the style of how they talked and whatnot?
I thought the way they talk was, like, fine. But sometimes it was, like, really hard for me as a Dutch guy, who doesn't speak English, like, 100% correctly and didn't grow up in talking English. It was hard for me a lot of times to even understand what was going on, because there are, like, some really, really, I guess, old words and words that that English people don't really use anymore. So yeah, there was a lot of looking up words in like dictionaries and online for me.
Yeah, I figured it would be. Definitely demanding and strenuous for you, because, I mean, even the way he framed it and phrased it and the prose was really difficult with his adverbs and adjectives, and some of them he didn't even write it like it would be typical English language. He wrote it in vernacular style to the region. Like, instead of saying over here, it would be O-ER and then space ERR over here and stuff like
yeah.
So if you don't pick up, like if you didn't grow up with English as your first language, then it would definitely be tough. And even as me, and I'm like really into the English lexicon and whatnot with language and grammar, it's still even tough and just not graceful in the way that he writes. So, but he is a smart guy. I could tell that. And there is some poetry in it at times.
Yeah, for sure.
But still, it's kind of a chore, and not in the enjoyable sense, because it was tough to get through.
It also suffers the pacing of the book.
Yeah, for sure. Because there's no action going on. We're just stooped in these people's lives, what they're going through, and just like their personal kind of like social jabs at each other, because there's really nothing going on in this town. Anyway, so they arrive in this town. The jogger shows up. He runs past them, not breaking a stride, unperturbed. Then he disappears. So we get a first glimpse from the jogger. Like we said earlier, the jogger does appear. The jogger from the cover does appear. He isn't a skeleton. He's more of a young human figure, like young male.
You didn't mention that he is like a very skinny, like almost skeletal face. But indeed, he's not really a skeleton like the cover.
Yeah. So he doesn't stop. It's just kind of like an ominous pass by. And he's wearing I do have to say, unlike the cover, he's wearing a green sweater and dark shorts.
That's what, like, kind of pisses me off. The fact that it's on the cover, it's blue. And in the book itself, it's green. I don't know. I just can't stand that for some reason.
Yeah, that was the one thing that was off from the cover and everything. Because he's in a traditional, like, sweats in the cover with a hoodie on over. But yeah. In this, he's got a dark green sweater. And it stays that way throughout it, too.
Yeah, I was reading it and I was like, what? Green? Like on the cover, it's blue. Why isn't it, like, blue in the book or green on the cover? Like, pick one color.
Exactly.
But anyway, that's a minor complaint.
So, in this town, they notice an uncanny stultification. There's no activity. The inactivity is palpable. So, it's your classic, there's something off about this town type of vibe.
Which I actually like. I actually like that classic vibe, indeed.
Yeah, it's kind of like Twilight Zone-esque, where you don't know what's going to happen. Like, I didn't, like, the back cover description doesn't really tip off, doesn't give spoilers whether it's supernatural or what's going on. So it leaves you in suspense there for a while, and it's tense for the first 150 pages, because really nothing happens. It just kind of establishes this business crew. They're driving out there. They all have their little bickering and feuds in between each other's, and they all have their own different facets of character. And so they set that up. So you're waiting. That's why it was a little tough to get into this too.
Yeah. I mean, 150 pages, and it could have been like, that wasn't so bad because you expected like something cool happening after that. But, if it was cut down to 80 pages, that would have gotten the pacing going more quickly and fluidly, I think. And it would have been more enjoyable, the development between the characters and everything.
Uh-huh. And the crew continues their endless banter and hunger for food in a town bereft, because they start to notice some of the more stranger things. At one point, I think they set up where there's no churches or bars in town. There's no junk food to be have. So it goes through each of these like six different characters noticing these strange things about the town. And
that's actually something I like. like the slow realizing that something is off in the town.
Yeah,
and it doesn't spoil anything. Like, you have no idea if there's going to be, like, a big monster in the end. But it does tell you there's something off. And I like a classic build-up, there's something wrong with this town type story.
Yep. And one of their big projects in town is they're developing ad space for this project, helping facilitate old buildings being restored by Dr. Dominique. So he's the huge benefactor that's kind of bringing them into town. So they're setting up for this down the road, this unveiling of his arrival to town and his different charities that he's providing and donations for the town and everything. And he also plans to rent out the auditorium for a big name comedian and stuff. So they're setting up this big event from Dr. Dominique. So we don't know anything about Dominique yet. We'll get into him later. So another thing is they're noticing that there's no obituary section in the town newspaper. And this is where it telegraphs that the whole town is walking dead because the jogger is on a boundless jaunt tirelessly. He starts showing up. What else? Yeah, so everyone in town's young, and there's no alcohol, and there's no junk food. So you don't really know what to think still. What were you thinking at that point? You thinking it was zombies or ghosts or anything?
I didn't actually think about them being, like, dead at first. I was just like, oh, that's another thing that's just off about it, that there's no pages for the dead in the newspaper. What did you mention it was called?
I don't know, but it was the town newspaper.
Yeah, it didn't have any pages for the people that died, so I just thought that was something else that was off, just like with the junk food and you know, that sort of stuff. I didn't really think about it as, oh, everyone there is dead, but that actually makes a lot of sense.
Okay, so the first thing we get to know is that's revealing anything other than the jogger being creepy is they're researching these group of scientists, and they start to name the Jagannath, which is a spiritual Hindu spirit. It's so obscure you really can't even find too much information of it online, except for that it does have to do with Hinduism. And they're feeding, there's also this huge winged type of pterodactyl or huge bird or something.
Yeah, it was described as a white bird and like it was huge or something.
Yeah, they're feeding it. It's one of their own experiments. It's called a Brexa. So it's another thing from an ancient type of religion. And so those are kind of introduced to. They're kind of showing up being creepy. And there's also a mortuary embalming scene. Come to think about it, I don't know why there is the mortuary and everything. They're there to kind of like spruce up the bodies or something.
Yeah, there are like multiple things actually in this book that are never mentioned a second time, or at least it isn't concluded or explained. It just kind of happens.
Maybe it's in my notes as we go here, because the characters that the mortuary are in it throughout, I can't remember if they're corrupted. Not that we want to get into spoilers just yet, because there's more here. Wes is strolling around town. He finds no entertainment shots. But he buys a VCR at a rental store. You remember that?
Yeah.
I don't remember what movie he got, but I thought that was interesting. That's why I like reading these old 80s books. Like
getting a VCR at a thrift shop, like I think, I mean, you could still do that, but it's just funny. Like here, it's like modern and all.
Yeah, because there's nothing to entertain him in town, so he picks up the VCR. So he's finding his own the own town folk peculiar. They're all under 40. The indefatigable jogger in green jaunts by him. Oh, this time Wes chases after the jogger. And he, remember this scene?
Yeah, vaguely. Like,
yeah, he ends up chasing. Like, he knows there's something off about the jogger, so he runs after him. And it actually lasts, like, several pages. I think they even go back to other characters, and then they come back to him. And he's, like, still chasing after the green jogger. But, of course, the jogger gets away, and he gives him this grim snicker. Wes did it to see where he was going, I guess, is what I have written down here. Okay. So, the crew of phone salesmen, our main crew of characters, our victims here, they fan out on town. They're doing their door-to-door sales. And they ended up entering a house beleaguered by poltergeists. Do you remember this?
I mean, vaguely, like the entire book.
Scene. There's a lot of random shit starts happening. It's basically like a whole bunch of nothing.
Which could work if there was like a big climax with everything coming together, like full circle. But it doesn't in this book.
Right. To this point, it was only like small shit, like, oh, the jogger is so scary.
The
like,
bird.
He's glowing in the bird. And then, like, they go to someone's house and they kind of spasm out. I don't think it's a ghost, but, like, the person kind of wigs out and kind of dies in a seizure. And there's, like, a little fire there. So it's a town of lifeless troglodytes, essentially, because none of them want to get any of the phone. None of them want to advance in technology. And none of them want to update the town or anything. So it's kind of peculiar in the sense that they're like all around 30, but they're all living like, you know, troglodytes, and then they're stubborn to advance. But we'll learn why soon enough. Soon enough. Meanwhile, Wes, who is still apparently chasing the young jogger, silently, and he finds, like, the young jogger is silent and snotty, is what they write down. He runs down this darkest trail lined with the bushes and the shrubs, and this is where he stumbles into the cemetery scene. This is a good creepy ambiance. This is where he espies the formidable vulture soaring above the moonlight clouds with the white wings. So this is when he's really introduced to the vulture. And Jay and Williamson seems to have a fascination with raptors or birds of prey. Because I know in Premonition, a book that you mentioned earlier, another book that I have, Jay and Williamson, it's part of a series. I've read reviews of it online, and someone says that there's this type of apocalyptic ending featuring pterodactyls. So he must have a thing for big birds.
Big bird fetish?
That's his thing. He thinks they're scary or something, or he has some sort of captivation for them.
Well, maybe he would like to read... Oh man, what's his name? The Nestling?
The Nesting by like Charles Grant or something.
Yeah. I mean, there's like a big vulture on the cover. Not sure what the rest of the book is about, though.
I think it is an animal attack book with a bird, because I have it too. It's like on my Tubi red list, it's probably like number 330 or something. So I'm
if that book is as good as its cover, then it's an amazing book because I love that cover.
If you have a thing for birds and everything, you might be willing to watch it. I mean, Animal Attack books I only like to read every now and then. Like, they're usually not that cerebrally insightful.
Yeah, and usually it's like the same type of build-up, you know, and structure of a story when it comes to bird attack movies, books, and like any sort of media.
Right, you have the scientist come in, he falls in love with the girl, he saves the girl, he saves the town, they get together in the end.
Exactly.
The Nesting kind of had that similar, or The Nest, I mean, but Greg Douglas, which is what I reviewed first in the Pulp Arcanum podcast back in the spring. Same kind of setup. Anyway, so OC, the old guy, ends up strolling down to the local pharmacy, and this is where he's like cornered off by the town locals and called an infectious disease old man, and he's beset and forced to leave the town. You remember when they confront him?
Yeah, I do remember that scene.
They don't tell him why or anything, but they just kind of menace him and bully him in town. So you're like, all right, whatever, moving on. So they all gather back at the hotel and they swap strange occurrence stories. They're like, yeah, this town, it really is spooky. And yeah, they told me to fuck off at the pharmacy, and I saw this weird glowing bird in the cemetery, and then there's that jogger, that sweet ass of the jogger with the perfectly shaped buttocks, and they have a VCR watch party, I guess, and you could tell nothing's going to happen. This is the part of the book where they all gather back at the hotel. And Ken tells Wes that one of the VHS tapes was an X-rated filming of Angeline and Kenny having sex. Okay, that's kind of weird. So they were filming them having sex, I guess. And it ended up as a video rental. Moving on, townsfolk meeting in the pharmacy, they discuss tactics of how to troll them better in order for them to leave. The sheriff, pharmacy owner, restaurant owner, caretaker, and undertaker didn't scare them away well enough. Then there's a meeting with the biochemist, has been experimenting on the town with anti-aging collagen remedies. So this is when we first learn of what's going on. This is why they're all young. The scientist, this main benefactor, this Dr. Dominic, he's got his scientists set up in this small town where it's experimenting on anti-aging remedies.
And I didn't like the fact that they even explained that. I liked the fact that it was like, I would have preferred if it was like a mystery, and if it was like, you know, it has like a mood, a sort of a creepy atmosphere, if it wasn't explained how they are all in their 30s.
Yeah, and they explain it a little more. They just hint at it here, so it explains a little bit of why they're all young and why they're all weird and everything. And the jogger strides past the sheriff outside, and he's got a crew cut, and he's glistening skin, and he's got a sickly sweet smell to him. God, I love the the best thing about this book is the adjectives of the jogger.
Yeah, for sure. I think he even wrote that on, like, a caption of the book cover.
You know what? Someone needs to, you know what they need to do is someone needs to make a cologne of the jogger's bony sweat.
How about a spin-off book all about the jogger?
This pretty much was all about the... Yeah, I mean... Yeah, And he even has a conclusion too, like, but yeah, they should just do a focus on him. If it was big enough, it would just be the Jogger 2.0. So Kenny leaves. He's too spooked out by the weirdness. That's the other leader of the phone group. And then Wes has too much involvement in the business, and they kind of get into a little fight with each other. And Wes meets with the scientist, Kuiper. He's the head of the scientists, about the oddities of the community and the entire factory of the lab coat scientists. There's no alcohol, no meat in town, no cigarettes. It really has similarities to Halloween 3, Season of the Witch. Have you ever seen that?
Yeah, I love that film, actually. It's like my favorite Halloween sequel.
Me too. So the fact that there's the similarities are there's a factory where there's a scientist, and they're making these kind of like clone type of docile leaders and experiments and everything, just like Season of the Witch. So, did you pick up that vibe?
No, not really, but now that you say it, that's actually like a really solid comparison, because it does really give you Halloween 3 vibes. I just didn't realize it.
Yeah, and he even infiltrates the factory, and he's talking to the scientists same way that Dr. What's his name? Dr. fucking Chalice goes in there and talks to Connell Cochran about it. So yeah, I felt that. That was really cool. So this Dr. Kuiper, let's talk about him. He's dwarf-like. He's under 30. Colorless, dreamy eyes. He didn't... What is this? I don't know what I wrote right here. It's kind of smudged. He doesn't hobble around like usual dwarfs. He has the nimbleness of the Jogger. And he explains that the youth are the key. It's an Auschwitz type of experiment with the elderly must be invigorated to contribute to society. So that's his philosophy on why he's trying to do this anti-aging. He's trying to make production out of the elderly. Okay. We learned about the Jagannath and Dr. Dominic. The Jagannath is a Hinduism avatar of the Krishna. And then on page 157, there's an expository scene where Dominic's family is known for their scientific miracles, and he's stoked by Oriental rites with the Jagannath. So you see what's going on here. They're mixing ancient occultic medicine with modern science to do these experiments. So that's the gist. What do you think of that?
I really didn't care much for that. I didn't think, like I mentioned before, it needed to be explained, and also not in such detail as that, like with all the science stuff combined and all. It didn't really catch much of my interest, to be honest.
Yeah. I mean, if he was going to explain it, he should have actually explained it instead of just kind of hinted at these different things and just been like, oh, this is what they're doing, Oriental Hindu with modern science. They don't really explain it. He spends time with our stupid phone crew talking about how there's not fried chicken in town. And we also learned that the statue that's going to be unveiled is a wooden figurine statue misappropriated from some Hindu culture. So it's a Wicker Man type of sacrament due for the climax, is what they hint at. Anyway, So we finally get a death here. Lucia, the woman who dies in a freak car accident in town. I don't know how that happens. She just kind of veers off and crashes Amityville Horror style, like it's accursed or something. And onlookers are gawking, and the Joker strolls by and her crushed corpse, and he doesn't even really emotionally react to it. The Joker is definitely peculiar and different and strange, stranger than the other town folk. I think that's evident. You remember this scene?
Not really, actually. I think I might have skimmed through that part.
So it was the first death, and anyway, so the Jogger rolls by, and Wes has a long, tediously written date, and it's with that one tall woman who plays basketball. Another worthless scene. You're like, bring on the horror, but they're still dicking around. Anyway, OC, his dad, is attacked by the virginal white bird. It's the apparition shows up in OC's hotel room, and OC ends up having a heart attack. So it's our second death here. You remember that?
Yeah, I do remember that one. It was kind of like vague as well. Like the main characters like Wes and all didn't really understand how it happened.
Yeah, it's presumed to be a heart attack because the vulture didn't physically snap his neck or anything, but it scared the shit out of him and he collapsed and died of a heart attack. So Wes is supposed to accept that. Anyway, so there's a trio of joggers now. Wes spots three eerie joggers with other runners who resemble the workers who have gone missing. So it's starting to be like a dead-to-the-world jogger zombie army.
Which I actually like that concept of this book.
So... yeah, they're just kind of running around, not really terrifying anyone, just being weirdos like usual. The scientists discussed this, installing this experiment with mysticism on the immortality, and it discusses the Rolongs, which is Chinese Tibetan zombie creatures. And that's what the jogger is. He's a perpetual motion machine. So we find out that the jogger himself was an experiment gone wrong. That's why he's a weirdo, because they messed up on his ass. So now, because they're invigorating him with youth. So they injected too much youth into the jogger, so he's got way too much energy. That's why he's always running around like he's hopped up on speed.
That's one thing I actually really liked about it. That's the thing that I did like, that it got explained.
Yeah. So that makes sense.
Why? Exactly. That's the thing. It makes sense. Like, so much youth, there's so much energy inside of him that he just doesn't stop jogging.
So they kind of view him as an abomination because they fucked up on that experiment.
Although one thing that doesn't make sense is the fact that they just let him run around the streets.
Yeah, what do you think they should do? Should they execute him or like strap him up like the old... insane asylum.
I don't know what they should have done, honestly. But I'm not think sure if about... letting him run around scaring people is the best option.
I know. Think about if they put him like in a straitjacket with like while he's like hopped up with all that vigor. Like he'd be and they put him in a padded room. He'd still be bouncing off the walls. Like that much energy.
And we learn that the statue, which is the Jagannoth, the Lord of the Underworld, heathens dragged it 90 feet. The Jagannoth, that's where the word juggernaut comes from. It derives from the Jagannath, a large, imposing, huge force. And so the sail screw discusses it. Maul's over leaving. Wes has his stay to bring to bury Osi and confront the adversaries at the statue unveiling. So it all comes down to this climax. At the statue ceremony, of course, the jogger has to be there. He's atop of the dilapidated building, jogging in place. This is hilarious. So he's a witness there. He can't stay still. He's jogging in place, like, fucking at the fucking statue unveiling. This shit's hilarious. So but Dr.
Domin- visualize that.
I know.
Someone jogging.
At like a solemn ceremony, like at this unveiling this black colossus type of statue, because Dominique unveils it and it is a black colossus from Nigeria. It's 8 feet tall. Actually, he's 8 feet tall. Dr. Dominique. He's a persuasive speaker and he does a speech on evolution and the man and humanitarianism throughout time. And are you with me still?
Yeah, I think I just lost connection there for a while.
Oh, it was my baby mama. She was trying to call. So we got to get through this, I guess. So the statue is a tall, wooden, crudely carved Jagannoth from India. And, like, it's a Wicker Man type of statue. It's an effigy. It's been stored for centuries, used as a tool to influence politics, and it's pretty imposing. What'd you think of it?
I liked it. I mean, I'm a big fan of, like, Wicker Man sort of stuff. I loved, for example, like, Midsommar this year. And I love those sort of statues. Those look amazing. So I could definitely visualize this scene very well.
Yeah, and you're a fan of Ari Aster's films, too, aren't you? His Midsommar and...
Midsommar was my favorite movie of this year.
Hereditary. Yeah, it's got that type of vibe. I like it when it gets to the Wicker Man type of occultic pagan vibe. So they inject that with modern science for this. And Dr. Dominique's the one who's the cultured occultist. And Wes's woman named Cheryl, we haven't even talked about her. That's how worthless every woman is in this. She's abducted by the jogger after smoking a joint. You remember that shit?
That was crazy.
She isn't even at the statue unveiling. She's back at the hotel, essentially, and the town... I mean, his breath stunk of death, it says, and she woke up sometime later. And they confront her because she ends up back at the hotel because nothing ends up. She ends up unharmed, kind of. It's kind of like they drugged her. Who knows what happened? They kind of threatened her to leave again or something. Anyway, the rest of the crew are like, oh, you must be high or something. And that's why you think you got abducted, because it was a cult of hooded members who abducted her, including the jogger. But they try to shrug it off like it's just the cult that lets Cheryl go after threatening her, and they act like it didn't happen or something, but Wes believes it. Anyway, so let's get to the conclusion here, because that's just another stupid, pointless scene. There's chemical elements that sustain the youth program come with risk, especially if regimen isn't followed. Dominique explains to Wes. So that's why things are going awry.
their experiment isn't exact. And if they mess up, then things like the Jogger happens, or abominations like the Balsa happens, and they turn they turn into terrors or horrors or abominations.
So that's what we learn. And if these subjects subverted their diet, it corrupted their biology to morbid effect. Now the experiment has gone awry, and it's on to, and they've created an army horde of zombies. So this is the conclusion here. And Dominique is like, I coalesced so many ancient cultures, science, into impeccable creations. And then he's like, the ley lines of different megalithic sites have brought about different conjurings and advancements. So that's why they're in Indiana, and that's why he's unveiling the statue, because it's on a ley line, a certain occultic location that's going to bring about some supernatural magic. So that's why they're in Indiana. And the Brexa is a Portuguese bird of prey. That's the white winged figure. So this is the final climax here. I have about a paragraph. They end up punching Akeem Dominic in the gut and hopping in a getaway car as the mob of undead chase them. You remember this? That's how they...
Man, I can only imagine, like, them sitting in a car, and then, like, the Jogger jogging after them in the sky. Like, just a little army of, like, craziness just chasing them in the car. I can only visualize that and just laugh. And, like, I'm not scared. Yeah. I would just laugh my ass off if I was in that car.
You gotta recreate and film that scene for your YouTube channel.
I for sure do.
So, fragments of the 100-year-old doctor start peeling off. We start learning that all these town folk are like 80, 90, 100 years old, who are in their 30s because they're successfully undergoing the transition. And so they end up turning the car around for a showdown at the Jagannath statue, because you're like, this can't be a climax. Are they going to run away? This is bullshit. So they turn the car around. They end up at the fucking statue, and it's on a ley line, like I was saying. So this fissure splits the ground, and it opens to this the Jagannath lurks after them, so the Jagannath statue reanimates to life and starts attacking them like a fucking Godzilla villain. And they light the giant on fire. That's what they end up doing, of course. You know. Fighting horror with fire is always a good conclusion in horror.
Oh, for sure. If you want to get your audience, like, bored, then do that.
If you have no ideas, default to the cliche of burning the shit down.
Just grab a Lucifer and burn the motherfucker down.
Like in the Amityville horror movies, they burn down the house like three different times.
Whenever you have like a trilogy or a series of movies and you...
Or like, like Nightmare on Elm Street. Like, oh, the town pedophile? Fucking burn his ass. It's not like he's going to haunt our kids in their dreams as Freddy Krueger with razor knives. Just throw him in the incinerator. And so the townsfolk end up
transforming back into their original form. Good for them. Which is old hags and geezers. That's what ends up happening in the final pages. So, do you remember the conclusion where the jogger turns into this enable? He turns into this anemic dude. He's old again. He's zapped of all his energy. His story arc is concluded.
He should have just fallen to the floor immediately, just
he blacking have out like
because he's tired as hell.
Yeah. So that's what we're left with. And Kenny tackles Dr. Dominique into the pyre. Remember how there's the fisser and they fall into the earth. And that's pretty much the conclusion of it. And so he sacrifices himself. Not Wes, whose dad ended up getting killed. Oh, because Wes has got to live on with Cheryl and everything. So that was Dead to the World, 1988. What are your final conclusions to wrap this up?
Well, it had potential, and maybe I just had a better story in my head and was expecting more. Yeah, this book sucks.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Jane Williamson, and I will wish you a happy birthday on the 17th of April when it's my birthday as well, but... yeah, I didn't like this very much. May you rest in peace.
Yeah. He even has that one horror book cover where it's that doll smiling, something evil or something like that. And yeah, it's like I've wanted to read so many of his books because he has so many classic covers. You know, you want to see if it lives up to the cover and everything.
Exactly.
I really don't plan on reading any more of J.N. Williamson for a few years just because that was just so tedious.
Me too, man.
And
I'll leave Horror House on the shelf for a few, years.
Yeah, I know. I'm going to be too horrified to even grab the Banishing. Like, I'm going to be too afraid to. Time flies anyway, but I'm going to take a little break from J.N. Williamson, maybe a decade or so. But so would you recommend this to others?
I would recommend Roger Walker's adaptation of this book into a movie to others. But that's going to take like 50 years before that comes out in theaters.
Yeah. If you're from Indiana,
no, I would not recommend this to anyone.
I'd recommend it to only people if you're from Indiana. It does some locale descriptions, talks about Indianapolis. Obviously, J.N. Williamson's from Indiana. So, in that sense. And I'm a person who loves detailed stories, but I love detailed stories where they describe, like, the decay of leaves on a gnarled up oak tree or a rusty hinge as a door sways in the wind on a old dilapidated cabin, or
not detailed writing where it's like it almost looked like the jar was flying.
Yeah, not detailed writing where they talk about OC and his date with Cheryl coming up and him doing bad jokes and talking like, yeah, well, we should really sign these people up, and how are you doing with sales and everything? And so it's misguided for sure.
Definitely, yeah.
So check for us in the future. I'm sure we'll hopefully pick a better book. Luckily, you didn't have to read it, and you had to live vicariously through us. You got lucky, because we had to read through this 400-page mammoth. Actually, it's only 364,
but it felt like a thousand. It might as well have been 1,000 for how much.
Definitely. Yeah.
Misery.
It involved.
Reading the Bible would have felt like a shorter amount of time.
I feel your pain.
We share in the same agony. All right, this was JBM from VillainNews.com and the Pulp Arcanum podcast, and Roger Walker from. Go ahead.
Slash your pepper.
And you're on Instagram, aren't you too?
Yeah, I have a personal account, which is Roger Walker without the O, E, A, and E. And also, I have a Slash Your Pepper Instagram account. Man, this was a ton of fun to talk about, not to read the book. But I'm sure next time we'll pick a better book. And thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, man. I look forward to the next time.
me too.
So tune in. Thank you. We're out.
Bye, guys.
The Witching Hour, number 73, from DC Comics, Witchful Thinking. Editor's Note.
Editor's Note. For those of you who came in late, our occasional references to Dracula in some past issues would have kept you up to date on all the hoopla which has been unearthed about him. Will the real Dracula please stand up? For the truth of the matter is that the novel by Bram Stoker was theoretically based on a real historical character who bore the unpleasant name of Vlad the Impaler. Why this ugly moniker? A dude by the name of Vlad Dracul, the Prince of Walakala, one of the main provinces of Romania, ruled cruelly and tyrannically, albeit effectively, in the 15th century. He had impaled countless thousands of noblemen and their families because he feared they were plotting against him. To scare off an Ottoman army advancing on his country, he set up a virtual forest of impaled Turks, threatening via with these gruesome displays that the same fate awaited them. And so, there would be no poor people, but only rich ones in my land, he sneered. He had old people, the destitute and crippled, slaughtered. Thus the novel, 80 years ago, based on the savage sovereign. Why do we pause to make mention of the famous blood-sucking Transylvanian vampire? Because the current regime in Bucharest is celebrating the 500th anniversary of his death, with a spat of sculptures, poems, and paintings being exhibited throughout Romania. Oh yes. Drac means devil. Do happy anniversary wherever you are, Dracula.
Dear editor, in a recent story, The Captain's Curse, you showed that a man developed leprosy in a matter of few days after visiting a leper colony. He passed it on to his girlfriend, whose skin corroded before you. Having lived in Africa for 4 years and meeting many lepers, I know for a fact that it takes many years to develop the disease. I feel you very unfair to depict lepers this way. Don't you think they have enough trouble as it is? Mary Steele, 1926, Virginia Dale, Helena, Montana.
Dear Mary, I'm afraid you overreact to my instant almost death by leprosy in the Captain's Curse story, and in doing so missed the point. It's not a story about lepers. It's a moralistic allegory about evil and the punishment of evil. I hasten to assure you that this is in no way implies that the punishment for evil is leprosy, except in this instance, and the fact that it is so fast acting, contrary to fact, proved by point. I've killed off the wicked in many stories, in many ways, with lightning to name one. It doesn't follow, then, that everyone who killed by lightning is evil. Yes, Mary, lepers do have enough trouble, as you suggest. So let's not infer that this story, that because an evil man is punished by a quick-acting disease, all who have made the disease are evil. Where else, Mary Steele, can you enjoy reading that evil is invariably punished? Please remember that next time you read The Witching Hour. Sincerely, Carl Wessler, Cynthia, Mildred, and Mordred.
Pulp Arcanum is a podcast featuring content and discussions on the pulp fiction genres of 20th century literature. Horror, adventure, fantasy, and sci-fi. The fantastical stories published in the 1920s pulp magazines ignited the era with an explosion of strange and weird tales. To participate in upcoming skull sessions on the podcast, email me directly at pulparcanum@gmail.com. That's PulparCanum. For Facebook, there's a page, Pulp Arcanum Podcast. Also, many paperback collection photos are featured on the Instagram.